On a typical Sunday morning like this, I'm sure that we all come to church with problems, with struggles in our lives, with difficulties that we're working through. And we're looking for answers to our lives. We're looking for answers, ways to solve those problems, ways to live life so that the pain is less, the difficulty is easier to take in our lives. We come with maybe problems of anger or bitterness. Maybe we've got financial problems. Money seems to be a little bit tight these days. Maybe there's sexual sin in our lives. We're struggling with it. It's difficult. It's painful. Maybe there's family conflict, and that too is painful. It's difficult. And we're looking for answers, looking for practical ways to solve these problems. What can I say to you? What do the Scriptures say to you? What does the Scriptures say about anger, bitterness? Say, stop it. Cut it out. Forgive one another. What do the Scriptures say about financial problems? Well, let's sit down. We can work out maybe a way that money can be there to meet your needs, to pay your expenses. What about sexual sin? Stop it. It's destroying you. What about family conflict? Communicate with one another. Forgive each other. Get all the cards out on the table. Work out the problems. Work out the difficulties. I could say these things. These are the things that the Scriptures say. But what really makes sense about life? Because I could send you to all sorts of different kinds of seminars that can tell you exactly, basically, these kinds of things that can help you work out the practical problems in your life that can give you practical truth. Summit, B50, Est, LifeSpring. They're all out there. They're expensive. This is free. But they're all out there. What really makes sense, though? What gives purpose to your life? How can your life really count? How can it be really meaningful? Because, you know, our consciences basically tell us the answers to our problems. We have a difficulty. We really, for the most part, probably know what we ought to do. We ought to stop sin. We ought to forgive one another. We know that. But what really gives life sense? What gives it meaning? God. And only God. What I'd like you to do is to maybe just kind of forget about those small little problems for a minute and to focus on the big picture. Because as I look back over the 12 years of my Christian pilgrimage and I think about what has really made a difference in my life, what has helped me in times of sin, what has helped me in times of difficulty, it's the big picture. It's God that's given my life meaning, that gives us a sense of life making sense, of there being a purpose. God and history, to put those two together, really it's His story. It's His history. He is the one who is bringing it about. It is His desires, it's His purposes that are being carried out. And it's His story that He desires to tell us, to teach us. It's the exercising of His own infinite attributes, of His purity, of His moral, of His goodness, of His wisdom. It's God as He's working in history. This is what God is up to. And so whatever the Bible tells us about the history of the world will teach us about God and His purpose, and will also include us. Because God had you and me in mind before He created the world. And so whatever His purpose is, however He's making sense out of life, it includes you and includes me. And so whatever the Bible is telling us, whatever story we read about, for instance, the story of David, it is teaching us about God's purpose specifically at that time, but also about history overall, because that story is there for a purpose. It fits into all of history. History is not just a jumbled mass of events that are occurring, one right after another. But history is God's story. It is all fitting together. And not only is the life of David fitting together in that, but so is your life fitting together in that with the same amount of significance, the same amount of purpose as David's story too. So there's always purpose in history, and there's always purpose in our lives. Well, this morning we want to look at the story of David in 1 and 2 Samuel and to see how it truly is the story of God. And what we'll see is that God's purpose is to be king over His people, over all creation, not in just position, because He's king over creation at all times, as far as just, I mean, He is the sovereign God. But it's not just in position, but He desires and purposes to be king in recognition. His purpose is that the creation will recognize that He is king. And as I mentioned, God had each of us in mind before the creation. In infinity past, He knew of you, and you were part of His purpose to recognize Him as king, as in authority, as the one to whom you should be loyal. And so, as I look at 1 and 2 Samuel, I think there are two stories that are the most important. One is the one that I taught on last week, and that is 1 Samuel 8. Because in the story of 1 Samuel 8, you have the people of Israel rejecting God as king. Now, how had God actually become king? Well, back when the Israelites were in Egypt and God decided to take them out of Egypt and take them over into the promised land, to the land of Canaan, as they were moving through the wilderness, God made an agreement with them. He said, if you will be my subjects, if you will pay attention to what I tell you to do, I will be your king and I will protect you. And I will provide you with what you need in life. If you need food, I'll provide the food. You need emotional stability, I'll give you emotional stability. All you have to do is listen to me and obey me. That is what we call the Mosaic Covenant. And so all through the wilderness, God, the picture is He picked up His people, He carried them, and He brought them into the promised land. And His only stipulation was, you must obey me. But here in 1 Samuel 8, we have a very remarkable point in history. Because after seeing all the great things that God has done for His people, the people reject Him. They reject Him as king, and they ask for someone else to be king over them. In fact, they wanted a human king. So the people rejected God and they broke the agreement that He had made with them back in the wilderness. And He had two choices. One of the choices was He could have destroyed them, because God being a righteous God, a moral God, you and I and the Israelites, if we're evil towards God, if we're evil in our lives, one of the choices that God has in dealing with us is to destroy us in order so that His justice is not violated. The second choice, though, was that He could have granted them their request and use their own sin for his purposes. And this is what he chose to do. He granted their request, and he decided for his purpose, for all of, as far as all of history is concerned, he was going to use their sin, even though they were an evil people and they deserved to be destroyed. But what does it take for a righteous, for a holy God to become king again, though, of his people? Because this is why I think what the story of David is telling us, that God wants to be king. He's not going to just leave it there. He's not going to just give the people over to a human king and leave it there. He's going to become king again. But what does it take for God to become a king again of an evil people who deserve to be destroyed? Well, the first thing is, he must forgive them. He must forgive them for their evil. But how can a righteous God forgive and not punish people for their disobedience? Only if someone else who is perfect in moral character, who is perfect in his goodness, dies for us. How can God forgive us? Someone must die for us who is perfect in moral character. I can't die for you. I can only die for my own sins. But who is morally perfect? Who is the one being in the entire universe who is completely and wholly good? God. But how can God die? He's the very source of life. How can he die for you and for me in order to forgive us, in order to become our king again? By becoming a man. What if God becomes a man? And what if he dies for his people? And what if he rises from the dead and then uses that same power that rose him from the dead to make his people obey him so that they're his subjects? He'll be their king forever. No more will people reject him. No more will they say, "You are not our king." And that's why 2 Samuel 7 is the other important passage in this story. Why don't you turn there with me? 2 Samuel 7. This is the other important passage in these books about the story of David, because here we see God's plans to regain his rightful status as king, his rightful position of king over his people through Jesus Christ. Let me start in verse 8. And this is God speaking to Nathan, who then is going to pass on, Nathan the prophet, who is then going to pass on this message to David. "Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, and that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again, nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly. Even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. When your days are complete, and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you, your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul when I removed it from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. God is saying here that one of David's descendants will rule over his people forever. Who is this descendant? In this passage, in this, what God is telling David here, he mentions a man who will commit iniquity, and he will correct him. I think he's referring here to Solomon. But ultimately, what this passage is promising, what God is saying to David, he's promising the coming of Jesus Christ to recapture the throne that God lost back in 1 Samuel 8, to regain his rightful position over his people, to be king over his subjects. And here he's promising that a man will do that at some time. So who is this man? Who is this one? It is Jesus. And the way that we can know that is that there was a very important ceremony back at this time, in David's time, whereby a man was separated to be the king of Israel, like Saul or like David. That ceremony was where oil was poured over his head and he was anointed king. And the word anointed in the Hebrew is the word Mashiach. Does that sound like something? It sounds like Messiah. We get our word Messiah from the Hebrew word anointed. The word gets retranslated in the Greek New Testament as Christ. Christ means Messiah. Christ means anointed one. But you see, it also means king. So Saul was anointed first in 1 Samuel 10, but he's rejected because he disobeyed God. Then David comes along, who is a man after God's own heart. But he too is a man who is sinful. He can't die for the people because he can only die for his own sins. Then there's all of David's descendants, all the kings after that, Solomon and all the other kings. But who is the ultimate anointed one? Who is the ultimate man after God's own heart? Who is the ultimate David? Jesus of Nazareth, son of David, son of God, Mashiach, Messiah, Christ, the Anointed One. So the story of David and the whole story of 1 and 2 Samuel is meant to point us to the kingship of Jesus Christ. To point us to God's regaining the rightful position that is truly only His to have. King over His people. King over all creation. Now David was really the first man, the first king whom God said is a man after my own heart. And 2 weeks ago we looked at how he was a man who tended sheep. He was a shepherd. We'll go on to see how he was a man who was a warrior for his people. He defeated their enemies. He's also a friend to a man like Jonathan. But you see, all this is a picture that is supposed to point us to Jesus Christ, to point us to God's ultimate purpose with this story, God's ultimate purpose with a man like David. Because Jesus Christ is the final king, the final Christ, the final Messiah, the final God. He is God. And notice the parallels. David was a shepherd. Jesus is our shepherd. In John 10, 11, he says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I'm not just any old shepherd. I am the good shepherd. I am God, because only God is good. David was a warrior. Christ is our warrior. He has defeated our enemy. The enemy that you and I fear the most, death. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 27, Paul says, "The last enemy that will be abolished is death." Physical death. Ultimate death. And Jesus provides that by being our warrior, our God, who has died for you and me. David was a friend to Jonathan. Christ is our friend. John 15, verses 13 through 15, he says to his apostles, but I think this can just as much apply to us, "Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends, if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you." Jesus, the Good Shepherd. Jesus, our warrior. Jesus, our friend and our King. Turn with me to Luke 23. I didn't want to read this by myself. This passage is so moving to me. As I look at the life of David, and as I see what God is doing in all of history, that I wanted you to be able to read it with me. Luke 23. And notice what is being said about Christ. Notice what Pilate says. Notice what the Jews say. Notice what is said about Jesus. Starting in verse 1, I'm going to read verses 1 through 7 first. Luke 23. "Then the whole body of them," that is the Pharisees, after they had first tried Jesus before themselves, "arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Christ, and saying that he himself is Christ, the Mashiach, King.' And Pilate asked him, saying, 'Are you the King of the Jews?'" Basically, are you, Pilate didn't know this, are you the one that 2 Samuel 7 was pointing to? Are you the one in the message that Nathan brought to David and said, "One of these days, God will rule over his people again"? Are you that one? That's really what is in the statement of Pilate, even though he may have not have understood it. And he answered, and he said, "It is as you say. I'm King. I'm God." And Pilate said to the chief priests and the multitudes, "I find no guilt in this man." But they kept on insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place." And when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. When he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was in Jerusalem at that time. And that's where Jesus was sent. And then the story continues. And I'll just pick it up with you in 32. After Jesus was led away, after he went before Herod, then back to Pilate, and then Pilate had decided that he deserved to be or crucified because he didn't want any more unrest from the Jews. This happened, verse 32. "And two others also, who were criminals, who were being led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, 'Father, forgive them.'" That's what was necessary for God to become King of his people again. "Father, forgive them, For they do not know what they are doing, and they cast lots, dividing up his garments amongst themselves. And the people stood by looking on, and even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, He saved others, let him save himself, if this is the Christ of God, his chosen one, according to 2 Samuel 7. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine, and saying, If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. Now there was also an inscription above him, This is the King of the Jews. And one of the criminals who were hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, Are you not the Mashiach, the Messiah, the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other answered, rebuking him, saying, Do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving what also we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And he was saying, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. Jesus is King. He has come to recapture his rightful position, to regain what God basically lost in 1 Samuel 8, to become our warrior, to become our friend, to become our shepherd, to be our king. And not just ours, but over all of creation. And this story of David that points to the kingship of Christ, that is there to teach us who is the ultimate man after God's own heart, the ultimate David is meant to comfort us. Meant to comfort us in our lives as we struggle with whatever we are struggling with this morning, the difficulties, the pain, that nothing is out of place in history. This is what is comforting to me. This is what permits me to go on day after day. This is what gives life meaning and sense. Because all of life, this story, your life, my life, is meant to point to God, to His kingship through Jesus Christ. Because Jesus is the ultimate David, King forever. Having paid the penalty as a perfect man, as God Himself, for our disobedience, and having recaptured the throne of being ruler over His people, which He lost in 1 Samuel 8. But unlike the situation with the Israelites, fortunately, that is unlike the fact that they basically had the choice to reject Him. God is not leaving it up to us to stay loyal to Him. Jesus didn't just die for nothing. He didn't just die with the hope, and by that I mean humanly speaking, that maybe you and I, having been chosen by God, might still be with Him, might still consider God as King throughout all of our lives and at the end of our life. But Jesus is making sure that we remain His subjects. In Ephesians 5, Paul's talking about the husband-wife relationship. He states about Christ that Christ's purpose is to present to Himself the church, His elect, His chosen ones, glorious, not rejecting Him, but embracing Him, longing to be with Him, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. You see, we are the ultimate Israel. The nation of Israel rejected God. You and I, as God's elect, if we believe in Jesus Christ, will never reject God as King. Never reject Jesus, because He is the author and the perfecter of our faith. But not only is this comforting, but for me, and I hope for you, this is what motivates me to do that which is right. When if you come here and you're looking for practical answers to your problems, you lack motivation to do what is good, you can't figure out what is right in life, what is going to keep you going? Jesus has regained his throne and will never lose it again. And that is your assurance. That is your guarantee. And that ought to motivate you to love and good deeds beyond any other people in this world. The fact that you have the assurance that God is your king, that he is your warrior, that he is your friend, that he is your shepherd who laid down his life for his sheep, and he will never give you up. He has broken the chains that evil had over us, the sin that only he could do by dying for us, that only a perfect man, God himself, could accomplish. But he's also commanded us to love one another and to obey him. So is there anger in your life? Is there bitterness because someone has hurt you? Forgive them. Be reconciled to them. Talk to them. Work it out. Because Jesus is your king. Is there a sexual sin in your life? You're struggling with it? You know it's wrong. Stop it. Because God has called us to purity, to holiness, to morality. You're having trouble being kind? Be kind. Be patient with one another. Because Christ is your king. He's regained his rightful position on the throne over his people. Be generous with your resources. Give to those who need, to your family. Give of your time. Give of your money. Give of your energy to serve them, to your friends, to your neighbors. Give of your time. Spend time with people. Don't be selfish. Do what is right because Christ is your king. To those who teach you the truth, and provide you with an understanding of God's purpose in all of history. And I'm speaking here specifically of men like Bill Acton and Paul Chaffee, who depend upon your resources in order to live. Do you have any idea the gift, the food that they are giving you that is God's truth? He didn't know I was going to say this. But what Bill Acton and men like him and Paul Chaffee provide you with is invaluable. Give your resources to them that they might continue to bring you truth that you can't find at Summit. You won't find it at Est. Sure, you might be able to work out family problems, learn how to communicate with one another. But you will never be told what really makes life sensible, what gives it meaning. That God used the sin of his people for his purpose to regain the throne through the man who was God, Jesus Christ, who is our King. And who gives us the motivation to do what is right. Looking forward to that time, longing for the moment when Christ will break back into history And all of the pain will be gone. And we will live with God forever, worshiping Him, knowing Him, growing ever closer with Him, always doing what is right. Long for that. Enjoy what God has given you now as He's changing you into someone who is good. As He gives you the assurance that you're His and that He is your King.